Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Over the past decade, Indian investors have undergone a significant shift, moving away from traditional assets such as gold, real estate and bank deposits towards investments in more in common with Western markets, including equities and equity-focused funds. This transition has locked new opportunities, with millions of households now actively engaging in long-term wealth creation. Today, we're speaking with Gaurav Narain, Principal Advisor to the Indian Capital Growth Fund. Gaurav, thanks indeed for joining us. What's the current market like for investors in this area you're involved with?
Well, the Indian markets actually is going through a very interesting phase that you're actually seeing a lot of domestic retail investors participating, and it's really participating from tier 3 and 4 towns. On the other hand, foreign institutional investors have been steadily exiting the market. So if you see the last 5 years, domestic institutions have seen inflows of almost $200 billion, while foreign institutional investors have pulled out about $8 billion in this last 5 years. So it's a very interesting trend that it's domestic institutions which are driving the Indian market, and the ownership of foreign institutional investors is possibly at decadal lows.
Okay, I want to pick up on those figures in just a moment if I can, but over the last decade, how have favorable demographics, structural reforms and digital infrastructure development shaped India's growth narrative?
Well, it's had a very big impact. India has actually historically always grown at a reasonable 6% plus GDP. Simply because of the demographics. But I would say over the last decade, what we've really seen is political stability, which has led to policy continuity. And you had a phase of reforms between 2015 and 2020. And subsequently, it's really been a lot on focusing on growth and investment-led development. So with demographics, what you're really seeing in India is a consumption and investment-led cycle. And it really accelerated post-COVID, where we've actually seen a real GDP growth of almost 9% per annum in the 3 years post-COVID. So really, it's a very growth-pushed economy scene with a lot of policy measures already in place.
So how have these broader economic transformational measures and implementations contributed to the exponential surge in assets you're talking about with India's mutual fund sector?
I think, when we spoke about reforms, one of the big areas we saw a lot of reforms or other investments was in the digital side, where the government took the ownership and lead. So what we've seen is the entire digital infrastructure of India is owned by the government. What it does is it's very low cost and very high volumes. And as a part of it, the government really started by giving an digital identity to every individual, which is today used as a KYC. And that KYC helped open a lot of bank accounts. For example, 500 million low-cost deposit accounts were opened. And it really led to a lot of financial inclusion. And with that and the sort of ease of KYC, everything being digitized, a lot of broking firms, insurance companies were able to really capture the rural or sort of semi-urban markets because it became very easy to open such accounts. And that's really led to this sort of inclusion, which led to people being able to invest in equity markets. So it's demographics where you have had a younger population, they were aided by the digital revolution. And I think the third aspect was very extensive marketing by mutual funds and the mutual fund association. So it's really been doing it for the last decade. I think all three factors have fallen in place. And post-COVID, you've really seen a surge in sort of investments of retail investors, particularly from smaller towns investing in Indian equities.
Let's put all this into some sort of context and go back into relatively recent history, but nonetheless before this surge in the equity markets in India. Why did Indian families and investors prefer traditional assets, as we see them and as I call them, such as gold or property and bank deposits, instead of equity markets? Just go back and explain more about the psychology of the investor a couple of decades or so ago.
Yeah. So I think it has a lot of the gold, at least, is to do with cultural and religious factors that, in all occasions, gold was a means of giving presents, or, you had festivals which were centered around gold. Even when weddings, one of the common gifts and something traditionally and parents give down is gold. So gold has always been a cultural factor in India. But I think the other aspect of gold was that India used to be a high inflation economy. So this was really a hedge against inflation. So typically, if you saw Indians, you know, the best hedge to inflation used to be gold and property. And if it was financial assets, it was largely in fixed deposits. So it's really very traditional. And to give a perspective, what I was reading was the total gold assets held in Indian households is almost 35,000 tons. And at today's gold value, it's estimated at close to $4 trillion.
Yeah, I guess you can see why people like to hold gold, certainly in uncertain times. But let's take a look at the domestic mutual fund industry and this expansion, this enormous expansion you've seen over the past couple of decades. What explains this? I think it's a 44-fold increase in assets under management up to, well, I think the last reading was March this year, to something like $770 billion. In the grand scheme of investments globally, of course, there's still potentially, obviously, I guess, a long way to go. How do you go along with this rise? And what do you think has really been behind this shift up?
Yeah, exactly. As I mentioned earlier, you know, it is education, it is digitization, which has made it very easy to invest in equities, and just demographics itself. You know, it's a young population. Historically, what really happened was it was only people in urban centers in the top 4 or 5 cities who invested in equities. It's really percolated down to the smaller towns. And a lot of credit really goes to the industry itself, which started marketing, investing in equities through systematic investment plans. What they really told investors was, don't ever try timing the equity markets. What you do is every month from your salary, put in a small proportion through a systematic investment plan in a mutual fund scheme. And that became easy because there were a lot of digital apps today which allow you to do it. You give a standing instructions, money is just transferred straight from your bank every month. And what you've seen, I would say, is that today there are almost 100 million such SIP accounts transferring as low as 25 to 30 pounds a month from their salaries into a mutual fund scheme. So what a trend which started at about $1 billion inflows a month about 5 years back, today is trending at close to $3 to $4 billion a month of inflows into mutual funds. And these are 100 million accounts. So it's really very small denominations coming from retail investors.
I want to pick up on the figures you highlighted earlier on in this discussion, because I want to talk about how the equity ownership structure in India has changed, particularly in terms of the declining state of foreign portfolio investors and the rising influence of domestic institutions. I think you were talking about an outflow, weren't you, of $8 billion net sellers, foreign FPIs. Since 2021. Why has there been this shift? Why hasn't there been a continuation of outside interest?
I think there's one principal reason, and that is that foreign investors find Indian equities expensive. You know, my discussions with most investors, they all buy the India growth story. But when they look at relative to emerging markets, India in absolute terms trades at a price earnings multiple of 23 times, which is close to the US markets. But what happened was that, you know, post-COVID, the economy did very well. Earnings growth was almost 20% per annum over a 3 to 4 year period. So while the Indian absolute valuations went up with the markets, what you found was most emerging markets were almost flat or had declined in that period. So the Indian equity markets on a relative to emerging markets historically used to trade at a valuation premium of about 60 to 70%. And this valuation premium went up to almost 120 to 130%. So when you're looking at from outside, from a foreign investor, while they did buy the India growth story, the fact that it was so off in terms of valuations over emerging markets, you know, foreign investors just felt that, you know, it's too expensive a market. And last year, what we did see was that earnings growth did slow down a bit. You know, it was growing at 20% and it came down to single digit earnings growth. So when you had a slight slowdown in growth and such high valuations, it really became a natural tendency that to park money in other emerging markets.
What have been the effects on Indian investor behavior of the catalytic events of the last decade or so? I'm thinking here the 2016 demonetization. We've had the fintech expansion. We've had COVID lockdowns. And of course, it all started 10, 15 years ago with the global financial crisis that occurred. Explain more about how investors have coped with these in some cases, black swan events?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot has changed. In the last decade, you know, India is relatively immune to global events in the sense that we are not as integrated with the global markets on the capital account. But the challenge used to be that anytime there's a global problem, the Indian markets used to fall. Even when the global finance crisis, I think India was the worst performing market, even though, you know, it was not impacted at all. And the simple reason was the foreign investors dominated the market. It was a very high beta market. So any stress in global markets and money used to flow out, and that used to have a huge impact on the volatility of the markets, even though the economy was not impacted as much. I think that aspect is changing now for two factors. Because the domestic institutions now control more of the market, that the fact of foreign investor selling is not as much. And to give a perspective, you know, since September last year, $30 billion of outflows have happened from foreign institutions in India. And though the market has underperformed, in absolute terms, it's been flat. This was impossible earlier. I think the second aspect that's happened is structurally, India used to have a very high current account deficit, which used to be anywhere between 2.5% to 5%, largely because we used to import a lot of oil. So we had a negative trade balance. That has improved a lot. It's today trending at less than 1%. And our oil intensity in imports has actually come down dramatically. So structurally, I would say we've become a lower beta market for two factors: that the macros are much better, and the dependence on foreign capital to drive Indian markets has reduced.
And of course, one has also to consider the effects of currencies on overseas interest when looking at investments. And of course, that may be also influencing how foreign investors treat the Indian markets. How has the rupee fared, and how has it either benefited or perhaps maybe possibly hindered overseas investments interest in India?
Well, what we've seen is if you actually look at the rupee versus the US dollar over a different time, be it 10 or 15 years, it's depreciated versus the dollar at about 2 to 3% per annum. However, having said that, it's been fairly volatile, and most of the depreciation happens in a very short period. So while the long term, you know, over a year, you may see it at 2 to 3%, but, you know, suddenly you have periods of, you know, 7-8% in a short period of time, and then it flattens out. So my estimate is even if you go forward, you have to build in that depreciation of 2-3% to the US dollar. And the simple reason is that India inflation typically has always been higher than the US by 2-3%. So you really take that and assume that the currency would depreciate by that amount.
I want to talk a little bit more about what's happening with the way in which these mutual funds are being promoted. How has the mutual fund Sahihai campaign, forgive my Hindi, contributed to the greater awareness and adoption of mutual funds, especially through visibility? My understanding is the Indian Premier League has contributed a lot to the visibility of this campaign. Can you explain a bit more about that and whether the benefit has really been felt?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's really been a very intense marketing by the Mutual Fund Association of India, which I think over the last decade has been advertising this campaign. It's basically a campaign which means mutual funds are the right choice. And, you know, the IPL is possibly among the most watched sports events in India. You know, it'll have a viewership of almost 400 to 500 million people watching matches on a daily basis. And that's been a steady campaign over the last decade. So that's really brought into limelight that, you know, one should be looking at mutual funds. But to add to this, it's also been driven by the individual mutual funds itself, who have been very, very active in promoting investments in equities, but through a systematic plan. So, you know, they've been really marketing, don't try timing the market, just put a small proportion into a fund every month from your salary. And that's what's happened, that even in volatile markets, for example, today you have this issue of global trade issues and Indian markets have not performed, yet the inflows continue. So if you see the five-year trend, even in periods of very high volatility and when markets have come off, the inflows have not stopped. And that's really showing that the people who are investing in these funds today are really not looking at it as daily returns. You know, in fact, a lot of them, what some of the distributors tell us is, don't even see how it's performed. You know, they'll have a look at it once in a few months at how it's performed. So that's a very positive trend that you're seeing, that the investors are really looking at it from a longer term perspective, which is where there's a lot of confidence that these, you know, the inflows will sustain over a longer period of time.
So in the context of that, what role does liquidity and small ticket sizes as well? You talk about relatively small starting points on these SIPs. What sort of effect does this play in making mutual funds more attractive than some of the alternative investment options in the market?
No, so what's happened is really people have low income. So which is why, you know, the regulator has allowed that a systematic investment plan can be as low as £1. And you'll find most funds take as low as a £5 investment through a systematic investment plan. Now, from a liquidity perspective, it's more the sort of money which is coming into the mutual funds, how they deploy it, because they're just flush with capital, rather than a retail investor having a liquidity issue. But what's happened is because there's so much liquidity in the market, it's also led to a very buoyant IPO market. A lot of capital is being raised in the Indian capital markets. And I was reading that almost a third of all IPOs globally are happening in India. So there is definitely a lot of avenues for funds to deploy this money.
So let's move on and take a look at more about what's happening with the digital revolution and how that's transformed investor behavior, and I guess democratized access to mutual funds to a degree. Am I right in saying that there has been this revolution based on technology?
Definitely, because the big shift really happened post-COVID. So really, COVID forced people to digitize. You know, even those who were reluctant to use apps were forced into it. And that transformed it, really. So it's really a five-year a big inflection which has happened. And if you see today, the two largest retail brokers in the country are all pure digital brokers. So that really reflects how digitization has had such an impact. And, you know, the credit again goes to the government because, you know, when they created that digital identity called Aadhaar, because of that, it's become very easy to open broking accounts or even bank accounts because this identity is used as a KYC. So you can sit in your house and within 5 minutes, you know, all your authentications are done and your account will be open within a matter of, you know, I mean, all background checks, etc. And everything happens in a very short span of time without you doing any paperwork. So that's really helped. It's just made things very easy. And again, you know, a lot of education has also happened. And even credit to the regulator, you know, which is very proactive to ensure that, you know, risks are mitigated.
Do you run stats to show just where the money is now coming from? I'm thinking about the expansion of digital distribution networks, potentially increasing participation from smaller towns and semi-urban regions. Do you have any stats that show that this democratization is really working and that people who previously may not have been interested in this sort of thing because it wasn't available to them, they're now being able to take part because of this technology?
Yeah, in fact, you know, the regulator itself keeps coming out with a lot of data from where the money is coming. And I think if you take out almost 80% of money inflows are coming from not the top 30 towns. So there's a lot of statistics behind where the money is coming from. In fact, we also have some pure distributors, which are listed companies in the equity markets. And we have a lot of data from their presentations on where it's coming. If you look at the top two, three broking firms, you know, they also list it. So you have a lot of data on where the inflows are coming from, the smaller towns, which towns it's coming from. So I would say a lot of data is there to back the fact that these are small tickets coming from smaller towns and it is genuine retail investors which are putting in money.
So let's take a look now ahead and ask you about 2026. How's that looking like for you at the moment at the Indian Capital Growth Fund?
I think what's happened is, you know, we had a weak 2025 in the Indian economy after three, four very strong years. And this was a year of consolidation. And what we've seen is that a lot of activity has happened by the government to really accelerate growth. You know, they've cut income tax rates, they've cut indirect taxes. The regulator, the central bank has also increased liquidity in the system, which had tightened earlier. Interest rates have come down quite sharply, much ahead of the market expectations. So what we've already seen is with all these factors, you're already seeing an inflection in the earnings growth cycle, where we're actually seeing upgrades and the downgrade cycle is behind us. So one is expecting that going into the next year, we are actually back to a double-digit earnings growth cycle. And we are actually seeing even our GDP growth numbers estimates being revised upwards. You know, till about 3 months back, it was closer to 6.5% for this current financial year. And now most have upped it to almost 7% for the financial year. So that's the inflection you're seeing. So I would say we are back to reasonably healthy double-digit earnings growth for the corporate sector profit. And which ideally should also mean that all things equal, the market should mimic this sort of earnings growth.
Of course, during the last year or so, the global economy, the global politics have faced all sorts of headwinds. So let's hope that things improve in 2026. And of course, also one has to consider as well the political relationships with governments around the world, particularly Donald Trump's Republican Party in the States. I know that India has had lots of discussions about trade and so forth. How do you view the current environment as we look again out to 2026? Is India fairly well insulated from all this because of the sheer size in terms of population? Or can you measure the effect of what's happening geopolitically and economically around the world?
Well, it's relatively much better off than most other markets, simply because 80% of your GDP is domestic driven. But having said that, global events does have an impact. Because if you're really talking about your GDP expanding beyond 7%, all your engines have to be firing. And unfortunately, what the global market has done is it has created a lot of uncertainty, especially since India has been slapped with a 50% tariffs by the US. Now, though it only affects 2-3 sectors, because a lot of other sectors have actually been exempted. But what it's done is, and it's created the uncertainty factor, which to some extent is affecting the private sector corporate capex, because they're, you know, a lot of them are in wait and watch mode. Now the feelings we are getting, and you know what the government is saying, is a deal with the US is imminent, and the government has also used this to accelerate its discussion on free trade agreements with a lot of other countries. For example, we've already signed with the UK, but it's now with the EU. They are in a very advanced stage, you know, and every day you read about one or two other countries where the government is accelerating the FTA signing. So it's also propelled the government to act faster. And what I understand is the US FTA would also be signed. It's almost imminent. So my sense is there are readings going forward are more positive than negative. But having said that, you know, it has affected sentiments, though it's really not had a very dramatic impact on the growth itself, because the domestic engine is still firing.
Well, look, I wish you all the best for 2026, and thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Gaurav Narayan. He's the Principal Advisor to the Indian Capital Growth Fund.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.